Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back to Your Health our guest co-host today, Carol Ripley Moffitt, who is the director of many behavioral change programs, including the Nicotine Dependence Program at the University of North Carolina. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Adam.
It's great to have you back. I know behavior change and health and promotion prevention near and dear to your heart.
Very much so.
And we've got some great research that matters, and we also have a guest today, Kenny Lynn, associate professor of family medicine at the Georgetown University School of Medicine. We'll talk about mammograms, policy versus medical evidence. But first, let's dive in on some of our research that matters. And our very first one, I think, is right up your alley. But it's a research about smokers and non-smokers when they're unemployed and how easy is it that they find jobs? Does the smoking status relate to their ability to find jobs? What do you think about this?
And I think beginning at the to think about the people who are continuing to smoke in our society tend to be people who have lower education and maybe some lower skill sets to start with. The other thing is that we tend to stigmatize people who continue to smoke, and that in itself can perhaps lead to lower employment or jobs that pay less.
Yeah, this was research that was actually done by a colleague that we know, Dr. Prochazka, who was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal, Internal Medicine. And they had 251 unemployed job seekers around San Francisco and California, approximately half who were daily smokers and a half who were non-smokers. And they then followed them out for a year and found out at the end of the year, close to 55% of the non-smokers actually were able to get employment, but only 30% or 26% of the smokers were able to get employment, suggesting there was a disparity not only in what happens, you know, before they start smoking, but even after they start smoking, the smokers have a much more difficult time regaining employment.
We also know that it's difficult when you're smoking. You're challenged. You're using all day long. You have to think about, can I take a break? What kind of job can I do that's going to allow me to continue to smoke? And what are the policies in place at work sites?
Yeah, and they also even found that the hourly wage for the smokers was much less when they got reemployed compared to the non-smokers. So, I mean, there's lots of – this is an observation study. It doesn't really say that the smoking status was the reason why people were unemployed and the reason why they got less money. Matter of fact, I don't think we – either of us would probably believe that.
No, no.
But it does suggest to me that if someone is unemployed and they're smoking, that that's still a time that we can – if they particularly if they desire to, we can work with them on quitting smoking. It's not the unemployment that's going to make it successful or not necessarily.
And I also wonder about just in terms of self-perception and when people consider themselves to be smokers, that they even have themselves a lower self-esteem. And maybe that feeds into this as well.
Great point. Let's talk about our next research that matters. And this is about the sugary drinks tax. And we've heard about this. We heard about it from the Bloomberg Foundation. We know about it in New York. And I think there's increasing interest to this across the world. And this was a research that looked at what would be the economic potential benefits, the public health benefits, what kind of revenue would happen in Australia if they did this sort of sugary beverage tax.
Right. And they talked about adding a 20% tax that was based on the cost of the drinks. And that included all kinds of sugary drinks that were non-alcoholic. They also excluded fruit juices and energy drinks, milk-based drinks in this study.
Yeah. And some of the things are kind of what we might expect. It raises revenue.
Of course.
But there's also a cost of implementing the measure. Mm-hmm. But what they actually also looked at is how much annual health care expenditures might be saved. Now, this was in Australia, much less populous than many areas of the world, including the United States. And it would reduce annual health expenditures by $29 million there because there would be 800 fewer type 2 diabetics. And after 25 years, 1,600 fewer deaths would occur each year and Australia. These are pretty significant health benefits.
The people in Australia also in a survey said that they would at least 65% said that they would support this kind of tax, but only if the money was used to reduce the cost of healthy food. And I think we've seen in the tobacco here in the United States that these taxes were supposed to go to helping people stop smoking, and instead they get diverted. So I think that's a key point, is can this extra income actually reduce the cost of healthy food for people?
Yeah, I think people could be suspect, and I think I am at times when you just throw it into the general tax measures and it goes to fixing highways when it was dedicated and came from, in this case, people who perhaps are obese or have unhealthy habits. And we have to be sensitive because it's a complex measure. But I think this will be worthy of more consideration, and it could create win-wins if done in the right way. Let's talk about our next research that matters, and this is about another health behavior. In this particular case, it's about the association of childhood or adolescent obesity and what happens when they get to adults, and do they have higher risk of heart disease based upon when they were obese as a child.
Mm-hmm. And then these were in late adolescent. These were Israeli young people who were followed. They found that in later life, they had cardiovascular disease, stroke, sudden death at much higher rates than in the general population.
Right. This was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and there was a database of 2.3 million Israeli 17-year-olds who were followed for over 30 years. And really, it was pretty phenomenal, and they really found that as that obesity, or what they call the body mass index, if you were above the 75th percentile, so presumably you're into an obese mm-hmm. category as an adolescent, you did have this elevated risk of all of these elements here, which would suggest, again, we don't know that that's the cause and effect, but it suggests that once you identify an adolescent or a young adult who is obese, it's worthwhile to try to reduce it while they're younger rather than waiting till they're older.
That, and just knowing that there were several possible ways in which the being overweight would impact the health, and that was both while they were adolescents in terms of increased blood pressure and a less favorable lipid profile, but also that once you are overweight in adolescence, the tracking along as you become an adult continuing to be overweight.
Yeah, those are great points. Let's talk real briefly about our last research that matters, Carol. And this is about testosterone therapy. So now we're going from the younger adult population to the older adult population and looking at what happens when people come into the hospital and perhaps through various testings they find out that you have an adult male has a low testosterone. That can happen for a variety of reasons, either biologically, they don't produce testosterone anymore. That may have to do with some illnesses, and it could be temporary. And in this particular case, they then looked at what happened with these men when they left the hospital, something called readmission rates. Why are readmission rates important, Carol?
Well, because you get penalized as a hospital right now if you have 30-day readmission rates. So hospitals and healthcare are all very much looking at these rates and trying to reduce this readmissions.
And in this particular case, they looked at these older men who then got therapy for the low testosterone, and they were actually less likely to be readmitted. The overall rate of 30-day hospital readmissions was 9.8% for those who were testosterone users and 13% for non-users. And they also looked at emergency readmissions with 6.2% for testosterone users and 10% for non-users. Well, there's lots more that can be talked about in the study. There's some belief that perhaps the testosterone in those who were biologically really low helps preserve muscle mass, exercising, which would all be benefits here. Certainly there are risks for testosterone use, particularly in people who really aren't biologically low.
And how do guys know?
Well, a lot of times they come into the doctor and sometimes they want testosterone, and it's incumbent upon to a really complete workup. This just suggests that for those who perhaps are really biologically low, there are some real benefits. We should not withhold it in those particular cases in any way, or at least have that discussion. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters, Carol. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Kenny Lin, Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the Georgetown University School of Medicine, about mammograms, policy versus medical evidence. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. Today on Conversations, Carol, we're talking with Dr. Kenny Lin, Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the Georgetown University School of Medicine, about mammograms, policy versus medical evidence. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Lin. Thank you for being with us today.
I'm glad to be here.
You know, you have written a really interesting article in the Journal of the American Medical Association about mammograms, and we're going to get into that in all sorts of fashions. But I think first off, we'd like to know a little bit about the person behind the writing. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Lin. How did you get interested in family medicine, public policy, and medical writing?
Well, so I feel like there are a couple kind of family, you know, people who become family doctors. There's, you know, people like my wife, who's a family physician and knew from the age of, I think, 8 that she wanted to do family medicine. I came to it much later. I went to medical school at NYU, which actually doesn't have a department of family medicine. It's one of the, I think, just 10 medical schools in the country that doesn't have one. And I kind of thought it out after I'd done some rotations in internal medicine and pediatrics and felt like it'd be neat to combine these things, but I wanted an approach that felt more like taking care of real people in the community instead of sort of the ivory tower academic approach that, you know, was taught in medical school. And family medicine was something at least was I'd heard of, and I went and pursued a rotation in Pennsylvania, Reading, Pennsylvania, got away from New York City, and kind of really fell in love with it at that point. This was close to the end of my third year. I mean, I was at the point where I really had to decide, so it was some pressure, but I was really glad that I had that experience because it really made up my mind.
And we know that family doctors have to keep up with lots of recommendations and understand what's going on, what's most recommended and most efficacious for their patients. Tell us a little bit about this article that you've written in the Journal of American Medical Association about mammograms and this confluence of insurance coverage, congressional oversight, and the U.S. Services Task Force recommendations.
And maybe we can start that by just set the stage for us of, you know, where were things at a year ago, and are they at the same place now?
I'd always been interested in preventive medicine, and I'd followed this. I think health policy is a more recent thing. I worked for the federal government for 4 years in an agency called the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, which actually part of its work was supporting this Preventive Services Task Force. And its recommendations, you know, basically, if it deems that certain preventive services, whether that's screening tests or preventive medications like aspirin or counseling for things like smoking cessation, alcohol misuse, if it deems that these are effective scientifically, then insurers are required to cover them. And so with mammography, the way that it stood a year ago was that the mammogram coverage was actually based on an old U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendation from 2002. And the reason for that was because that recommendation said it was recommended for all women over 40 to have mammograms every 1 to 2 years. But this was a clause that was due to basically expire from the Affordable Care Act, and nothing had happened to intervene, then the recently updated 2016 mammogram recommendations from the task force would have been the ones that determined insurance coverage.
And how had those changed?
So in 2009, the task force, I guess some people look at it as they reversed themselves. I think they look at it as they clarified their position.
Sounds like a politician.
Sort of like, yeah, I mean, that's where the sort of politics comes into it. They're very non-political, though. I mean, I think that politics comes in sort of after they've done their scientific analysis and people are trying to decide how to spin it. And in this case, you know, mammograms have always been very popular politically. It's very, you know, no one is against. You can't find anyone who says, well, I'm against or I'm for women dying from breast cancer. You know, I'm against screening women. You know, obviously, these are important tests that do save lives. But the task force found that in women younger than age 50, specifically the group between 40 and 50, who historically had been always recommended to have mammograms starting at age 40 every year, they found that the benefits were smaller than people had previously estimated, and they realized that the harms, particularly false positive tests, were very high in this age group. And they felt like the balance of those benefits and harms was close enough that they couldn't make a sweeping universal recommendation for that age group, that it was too close a call, and this really should be something that's discussed between a woman and her physician rather than automatically ordered.
Yeah, so the task force gave this a grade C to mammography tests in women age 40 to 49. And explain to our listeners, if you could, what's the difference between A, B, and C? I mean, I think we all know if you get C's all the time in high school and college, you're probably not going to have a great necessarily opportunity compared to those who get A and B. So we know that A is great, B is pretty good. Most would say C, barely passable.
Yeah, and it kind of aligns with that. So it's kind of intuitive. Like you can get, you know, a C doesn't mean you failed. It means in the way the task force looks at it is something, a service with a small benefit may help a few people, but may also hurt a few people. And because the benefit is small, sort of if you look at thousands of people, like only small numbers will benefit, they feel like this, you know, this is too close a call to make a universal recommendation. Whereas an A or a B, they kind of feel that reasonable people, reasonable patients and reasonable doctors would want to do this service. So mammography for women between 50 and 74 is a B recommendation because they feel like in this case the benefit is much much greater than the harm, and most patients would agree to undergo it. So there doesn't have to be as much of a discussion about the pros and cons.
Is there anything particularly about mammography and breast cancer that makes this issue a little bit more hot button?
I'm not sure. I think breast cancer has always been kind of a hot button issue. There's always been a lot of, you know, funding, advocacy. You know, I've always been struck by the month where the NFL and everybody's wearing pink shoes and they've got pink everywhere and how incongruous it is. But because it is an important issue, and I think partially because it's a cancer that strikes younger people. Like a lot of cancers are cancers of older, like prostate cancer, generally men over 65 or over 70. Whereas breast cancer, unfortunately, strikes a lot of people in perfectly healthy middle age where they've got many years left. So that, I think, adds a lot of emotional power to it. And also various people in the past, like celebrities like Nancy Reagan or, you know, who've revealed they had breast cancer and really pushed an aggressive approach to trying to detect it early.
So we have certain diseases like prostate cancer you just mentioned, Dr. Lin, where you know, several years ago, everyone, family docs, you, myself, our colleagues, we were all doing PSA testings all the time. And then evidence came out that suggested that that didn't provide the benefit that we thought it might. And so those kind of, among at least many family docs and patients, kind of quit having them done. But it didn't, insurance companies still paid for them. So what's wrong with insurance companies continuing to pay, let's say in this case, for mammography for women age 40 to 49? What's the problem?
I don't actually think that there's a problem with insurance companies paying for it. I think PSA is a good example. It's not recommended.
The prostate-specific antigen.
Yes, prostate-specific antigen is not recommended by the Preventive Services Task Force, and even groups like the American Urological Association don't recommend it for every man. They say you should have a discussion before you would ever order that. And so having insurance coverage means that it's an option. So in this case, you could look and say, well, by ensuring insurance coverage for continuing for mammography, you know, Congress was doing a good thing. They were just trying to defend the rights of women. And I don't really have a problem with it being provided, but my problem was more the way that this came to pass and what it said about science and the task force. Basically, what it said about science of mammography, or what it really didn't say. Which seemed to imply that it's all benefit and there's nothing to really think about, which is really an old and I think outdated philosophy for this test.
Well, you say how it came to pass, but right before we take a break, just outline what the real problem became and what did Congress do?
So Congress basically, they in a piece of legislation that was a big budget bill that really had nothing to do with health care, a provision was added which just had pertained to mammography, where they basically instructed insurers that for the purposes of coverage, they were to disregard not only the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force's 2009 recommendations, but their 2016 recommendations, making the document that they should consult a 14-year-old document they produced, which really doesn't represent the latest science, implying that the science they've done since then was just wrong or somehow biased, which isn't the case.
We're going to take a quick break and appreciate very much this opportunity to talk with you. We're talking with Dr. Kenny Lin, who is Associate Professor of Family Medicine at Georgetown University School of Medicine, about mammograms, policy versus medical experience, and we'll be right back.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We've been talking with Dr. Kenny Lin, Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the Georgetown University School of Medicine, about mammograms, policy versus medical evidence. And right before the break, Dr. Lin, you kind of outlined how Congress kind of inserted themselves into this issue, and they essentially wrote into the legislation relying on 2002 guidelines, not the most recent guidelines on mammography. What's the impact that that sort of element has on both policy, but also when a woman comes into the doctor's office? Does it have an impact there as well?
Right. And I think that it has an impact in both places. I mean, policy-wise, it's pretty straightforward that by declaring that the 2002 guidelines were the ones to refer to, they ensured that insurers would not withdraw coverage for mammograms for women under age 50, which I don't disagree with. I think they should probably continue to cover it, for women who are well-informed and have had the discussion with their doctors. But the issue is that in the exam room, what happens is that the doctor feels less incentive to really have that discussion. Why bother when it's guaranteed to be coverage? Covered. Congress said that everything was fine, and that this Preventive Services Task Force doesn't know what it's talking about, and so essentially Congress invalidated the two most recent guidelines on mammography, which did rely on more recent science and I think a better understanding of the trade-offs that occur when a woman decides to get a mammogram or not.
And is this the first time that Congress has done something like this that's opposed to the guideline recommendations?
No, they actually did something similar. You can really depend on Congress to keep revisiting things. But in the 1990s, the National Cancer Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health, had a conference where they invited experts from all over the world on mammography and cancer, breast cancer, basically debate and come to some recommendations about what should happen when a woman is less than 50 years old and doesn't have any particular strong risk factors for breast cancer, like a family history. What should she do? And they ended up actually producing a guideline that was very similar to what the Preventive Services Task Force has produced in the last several years, that they felt it should be an individual decision. And then the U.S. Senate promptly, without any urging, they just went and did this. They voted 98-0. I guess two people weren't there to disagree with the guideline, to strongly condemn it. And as a result, the director of the National Cancer Institute decided to overrule the expert panel that he had convened, and to state at that time that the Cancer Institute, despite what its experts had told them, was still supporting universal and routine mammography for women starting at age 40.
Well, don't we have an issue with thinking that this is the politicians are doing this? But the politicians, if at least in a democracy, are doing what their constituents are advocating for. So what are the forces? Do we know what the political forces are that really push this through? Because that's where some of the and it may be us, right? It may be colleagues and advocacy groups and provider advocacy groups and others who reap economic benefit from greater mammography use. I assume that there's perhaps some concern about that.
Oh, absolutely. I think that there are both physicians and patients. There are many strong advocates, even among family medicine, but certainly among radiology, among oncology, to screen sooner, screen more often, find more patients with the idea that that's going to improve their long-term outcomes, that if we can find more early tumors, we can treat them, perhaps cure them, and avoid a death or serious consequences from a more advanced cancer. But the problem is that most of the stories that are told about mammograms are that a woman is screened, they find a small tumor, it's successfully treated, and she feels that her life was saved, when in fact the situation is not that simple, that many, many tumors that mammography finds were destined to not really be, really ever cause symptoms in some cases, or in some cases not didn't need to be discovered until later on in the course where they would have done just as well. But you don't have that counterfactual, and you also don't hear, all the women who've undergone multiple false positive tests, undergone multiple biopsies, been, really scared and panicked, and and all for nothing, because many of these turn out to be not cancer and just kind of the limitations of the test.
That cycle of false testing and unnecessary biopsies and the fear that one goes through.
The emotional cost that roller coaster I was trying to find, that you feel if you have a positive.
Absolutely. I can actually give you, the statistics that the task force looked at for comparing starting mammograms at age 40 versus 50. And you can, and they'll give you an idea of how close the trade-off this is. They felt that, based on the scientific evidence, if you delayed your first mammogram till age 50 instead of starting at age 40, then 1 in 1,000 women who chose to do that would die of breast cancer who otherwise would not have died of breast cancer. And so that's the benefit of starting mammography earlier. But the trade-off was that the women who started mammography earlier, more than half of them, so more than 500 out of 1,000 of them, would have at least one false positive, meaning they would be called back. There was something they couldn't see, but it might be cancer. Several dozen would have biopsies that would turn out to be normal, but they'd have to undergo this inconvenient, painful procedure and sort of all the anxious waiting that goes around wanting to know what the result is. And worst of all was that two of them would be treated for breast cancer, which otherwise would not have harmed them. And this is something called overdiagnosis. It's hard to understand that there would be cancer that actually wouldn't do anything to you, particularly in someone who's younger, and it being breast cancer, which we think of as universally bad and something we need to get rid of. But the scientific evidence is pretty clear that for every woman whose life is saved by mammography, there's some number of women who undergo treatment that turns out to be unnecessary. But you never know that going in, so pretty much everyone has to be treated once they're diagnosed.
Are there other circumstances in medicine, in your experience, Dr. Lin, in treating patients, where kind of doing less, it goes against the grain, but it seems to take hold? And I'm thinking of potentially some treatments at the end of life, where maybe 10 and 15 years ago we were doing a lot more, but sometimes we recognize that doing more isn't necessarily better. And so I wonder if you have kind of hope that the political process can follow the evidence rather than the vice versa.
Well, I think that's a great, that's a great point. End-of-life care and the recognition that we do such a lousy job with care at the end of life. Often at the end of life, we're not providing care so much as we're doing things to patients that are painful or otherwise inconvenient or risky. There, for many screening tests, there's a caveat that, you should screen up to this age, but only if the patient is going to live more than 10 years. I think you can probably say that for prostate cancer. You can probably say it for breast cancer. For many things, the test is only worth it if the person is going to live at least 10 years, because it takes that long for you to see the life-saving benefit from a tumor that takes many years to progress. But survey after survey has shown that doctors repeatedly are They're doing screening mammograms on women who are in hospice, or they're doing interventions on people who have are expected to die within the next 3 to 5 years from, for example, emphysema. But they can't stop doing them because either habit or not wanting to confront a patient with their prognosis. There are many reasons why physicians and patients sort of cooperate to do unnecessary things because maybe they don't want to admit the uselessness of the additional testing.
That's an excellent point in terms of both from the provider and from the patient. How much risk are we willing to live with, and what's really in the best interest of each of us as well as our population as a whole. And we've really enjoyed having this time to talk with you today. Is there one take-home message that you would like to leave with our listeners about this framework that you've proposed for mammogram screening?
Well, I think particularly for women who are younger than 50, I've entered that age group with where everybody who I went to high school and college with is, or all the women, I should say, are facing this decision that if a doctor sort of says, well, you have to get this, then you really need to stop the doctor and say, well, can you tell me what are the trade-offs? And if they can't really, if they only look at the screening test as one-sided, there's only benefits, there's no harms, then you may want to seek a second opinion from another doctor because all tests, just like all medical interventions and drugs and things like that, are going to have downsides. And doctors are used to only looking at the upsides, but I think that the movement in medicine now to prevent care that is either unnecessary or undesired is to really grill your physician about what are the downsides of the test, what can I expect, and then you can make that decision about whether you personally feel like undergoing the test or not.
Well, we really appreciate that framework that really has this balance, as Carol mentioned, between the patients and providers, and thank you for being our guest today.
You're welcome.
We've been talking with Dr. Kenny Lin, Associate Professor of Family Medicine at the Georgetown University School of Medicine, about mammograms, policy versus medical evidence. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Carol and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if you have a question you'd like us to address in an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question.
I recently had a pelvic exam during which my doctor told me I had an ovarian cyst. I was pretty scared, but my doctor told me that it would probably just go away on its own and not to worry about it. But I'm still a little concerned. What do you think?
This is a great question, and I can just unfortunately see this playing out in a doctor's office where, doctors say, oh, I hear a little heart murmur. Don't worry about it. I feel just a little cyst over here in your ovary. Don't worry about it. I, from the doctor's viewpoint, it's like they're just like saying what's in their mind. But
you're thinking, oh, my gosh, it's going to burst. What happens?
Or a cyst. That's cancer, isn't it? Or, is this going to keep getting bigger and then I have to have surgery? All kinds of questions. Carol, I don't know if you've ever been told something by a doctor that, you kind of take a step back and you say, can you explain that to me?
Right.
But really important issue.
Understanding is, what causes this kind of cyst and, what are really the health risks that are associated with it?
And what kind of follow-up do I need to have? Mm-hmm. These are all questions. This really kind of begs more questions. It also depends on the age. If you're young and, a cyst around the ovary will happen normally around the time of one's cycle, and so therefore one can predict that will go away. If one's having pain, that's very different. If one's kind of near the menopause or after the menopause, any sort of cyst would be abnormal. And so one would want to do an ultrasound, and ultrasound would be a non-invasive way of evaluating that cyst. So there needs to be follow-up here regardless of its cause, and certainly more communication. Thank you for that great question. What's our very next House Call, Daniel?
I've been having conversations with my family for years about losing weight. I'm obese and I know the risks of that lifestyle, but I can't seem to keep weight off with diets and exercise. Are there resources I could maybe get from my doctor to help me?
Well, you're not alone. You are not alone in making this request and in trying diet and exercise, which are the two leading interventions that even your doctor would recommend. But there are medications, and they're for those who have an extremely difficult time and whose health has the potential to be compromised. There are also more invasive, like bariatric surgery options. But again, that's something definitely you'd want to discuss with your doctor.
Yeah, and I laugh because the question had anything humorous for it, but that because we're sitting here with one of the experts in the region on really intensive behavioral therapy and a new program that was started at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine on a weight management program, because we recognize this exact scenario plays out in doctors' offices around the country, that it takes more than just simple advice, you need to do this. It takes more than just, you know, I'm going to follow this diet. It really takes sometimes a team of people working to improve health, and that's what could occur here. You can do it. That's a big message, right, Carol?
Exactly. Getting the right kind of support and just understanding your daily routine and your lifestyle can be the start of being able to take control of your weight.
Ask your provider, does your practice offer a coach, maybe a nutritionist, dietitian? Really start with an extended team of folks, and if not, get a referral to a place that maybe offers that for you. Thank you for that question. Daniel, what's our next house call?
My father just moved to live with us, and he's pretty sick. I think it's going to be difficult to get him to a clinic, and I also need to find him a doctor. I have a family doctor, so should I look to him to see if he could come, or should I go to a private service that will come see my father in the home?
Well, first off, what a great thing that you've brought your parent here who is sick, because clearly they needed perhaps more care than they were getting, and you're doing something that I think is holy and wonderful.
Yes, and if you have a family provider, a family doctor, that's the nature of the beast, is to provide for health care across the generations. At the same time, it depends on that your parents' needs and desires as well, and they need to be taken into consideration as you think about finding a provider.
You know, almost every family doctor that I know of has been trained and has done house calls, and many I can't say if your family doctor will do house calls. I know at the University of North Carolina, Department of Family Medicine, that's how we're trained. That's what we do. We do know that there are some businesses that have sprung up, and perhaps in other places around the country, where they just do at-home care, and they can provide good care. If you can get this coordination of care between what happens in the home and sometimes what happens in the hospital, because oftentimes those patients also need hospitalization, that coordination is great. So I look for ways of increasing coordination. You got a good family doctor, I would start and ask that family doctor, are they willing to take on a new patient, and how best they may be able to meet your needs. What a great question. Daniel, what's our last house call?
I'm a recent college graduate, and I smoke and occasionally chew. I really haven't had any problems from this, but my grandmother actually died of lung cancer. Right now, I'm pretty stressed, so I don't think it's a good time for me to quit. But at what age can I quit and still avoid health problems?
This question has packed full of great, interesting, important issues. Thank you for the question. Carol, what are your thoughts?
Well, we don't know how to predict when health consequences will take place if you smoke. But we know that the stress that's involved when people smoke is added to the stress of, even though it may seem like there's a momentary stress relief, the stress of the withdrawal, needing to pick up a cigarette and light the next one, is a continued stress that happens all through the day. So studies have shown that people who stop smoking actually reduce their stress overall. In terms of long-term consequences, right now you may not be feeling much of a consequence from your smoking, and it's not just the fear of doing lung cancer that your aunt had or a family member had, but it's thinking about how do I want to spend the last years of my life. Do I want to carry around an oxygen tank? Do I want to have a better chance of living fully and a good quality of life up until the end of life? Just some things to consider.
I've had lots of patients that come in who are in their mid-20s, and they say they're getting married, and their spouse says they have to quit. And so sometimes things happen earlier on, or they have a child, and they don't want that child to be exposed to second- and third-hand smoke. So I'm going to reflect that question back on our questioner, Carol, and say, this person's actually concerned, or they wouldn't have written the question. And so this is where someone like the Nicotine Dependence Program at the University of North Carolina or any of the other places where one can get a quit line, 1-800-QUIT-NOW, people can call and get counseling frequently, a patch or gum or a lozenges with combined medication and counseling. These things really can help.
And the longer the longer you continue doing something, the more difficult it is to stop. So I think if you talk to people who are in their 30s or 40s or 50s now, who would say, I wish I had not continued smoking when I was younger. It would have been easier at that point to stop than it is now.
Maybe save a couple thousand dollars.
Well, not to mention the cost, yes.
Well, that's going to conclude Your Health Today, and we want to thank all of you for joining us. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu, visit us at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Dr. Kenny Lynn, and I'd especially like to thank my guest co-host today, Carol Ripley Moffitt. We hope you can join us next time on Your Health.
And so on behalf of Your Health, I'm Carol Ripley Moffitt, and we look forward to talking to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.